My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy.
I'm very glad to be here tonight. Glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. Didn't used to be. Might not be again sometime, but I'm glad to be here. Glad to see a lot of old friends. Glad to help celebrate John's 40th birthday. John, I'm going to tell you something you won't hear very often down here. It's nice to see you newer people staying active. And there are several people in the room that I've had the privilege of sponsoring. Two folks in the third row there that we sent down here from our Pacific group some years ago as missionaries. They sold out. They forgot they're supposed to wear with shirts with collars when they go to meetings. I guess you got to blend in, you know. One of them did something that I'd never had happen to me before. This will cheer all of you up. I came to Miami to speak, and my friend picked me up at the airport, my ex-baby that I'd sponsored a number of years in Los Angeles, dropped me off at my hotel about 7 o'clock, so he'd get in touch with me in the morning, we'd go examine Miami, and away he went. And they had no registration record of me at that hotel. And I didn't know what to do. I called Los Angeles to get his cell phone number in Florida and got it. And he was doing something else. And I sat in the lobby and gnashed my teeth for about 3.5 hours. Finally, the phone rang. It was him. And he said, what do you want? And I said, you don't have any reservation for me at this goddamn hotel. I didn't feel that way, but I was just trying to be strong in my remarks. And he said, oops, I'm going to call somebody. And he called somebody and called me back and said, I got some bad news for you. I dropped you off at the wrong hotel. But I said, well, live and let live, I said. Or something like that. But anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight. I know we have some new people here tonight, and you've come here at, I think, what I consider to be a splendid weekend. You're going to hear a lot of people tomorrow and Sunday who have been sober a long time, who are very well qualified to speak on the subjects they're going to talk about. And you may wonder, what's the big deal about the steps? We all heard about the steps. And I want to just put this in perspective, if I can. There's been written history of alcoholics for about 4,000 years. And seems to be different experiences that fool people. So we start with this premise. There are types of alcoholics. Nobody seems to talk much about it, but there are. There's a type of alcoholic who seems to drink and get in trouble, have problems, can't stop. Something happens that really threatens their security. Maybe they lose a job, maybe they lose a family, maybe somebody dies, and they quit. And they never drink again. And many of us know people like that. They used to drink and quit. And the same type of person, if they have become addicted to alcohol, which we don't hear much about either in AA, we hear about drug addiction. Let me tell you something. An alcohol physical addiction is much more lethal than drug addiction. You withdraw somebody from drugs and they get awfully sick. You withdraw somebody from alcohol addiction and they go into convulsions and sometimes die. But these people are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw the patient step by step, show them the error of their ways, physically make sure they don't go into bad situations. And they come out of the treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks, and they quit. And they never drink again. In fact, there's a hospital up in Seattle called Chic Chadel. And they advertise, we will cure your alcoholism in 1 month, including follow-up treatment. And we think, how silly. But they do. They have a long list of names who have been saved by that program. That's one type of alcoholic. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by the way you measure them. They drink and get in trouble, have problems, can't stop. Something that happens that really threatens their security. And they quit. but they always eventually drink again. And these same type of people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. And they never stay sober. They always drink again. And these are the type of alcoholics whose stories have been legion throughout the past 4,000 years. People can't imagine what's wrong with these people. At one time, they thought they were possessed by devils and put them to death, some of the extreme cases. England deported them. Everybody flogged them and put them in insane asylums and jails and all sorts of, in the stocks. And in all this time, in my lifetime, when I was a little boy, there still was no answer for them. Just think, after 4,000 years, there was no answer. I usually get a little further into my talk. Well, I'm sorry. In a memorized talk like this, I'll have to start over. My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. But anyway, these social agencies have worked with these people. Religion has gone to the wall for them. Medicine has tried everything in their power. There's never been any answer. Probably, most of us probably have not seen a great deal of the medical or psychological or psychosomatic treatments that they used on people like us. But what people of our type seem to have, and when I say people of our type, because this book, Bill Wilson, talks about alcoholics of our type. That's our type, the type that always drink again. And one thing most of us have in common, I think, sooner or later you see in the face of a loved one that terrible look of sadness, and they say, "How could you? How could you? You promised. You were doing better. Things were starting to straighten out. And here you are drunk again. How could you do that?" And there's no known answer to that except leave me alone, because I don't know either. And that's what makes this illness such a dreadful thing. And most of you who are, even if you're new, know that two guys got together in 1935 through a series of events, created something that today enables maybe 2.5 million people, alcoholics of our type, to stay sober in 134 countries. Unheard of in the history of the world. There are more people sober in this room now than were sober in 1940. And here, we just take it for granted. And what's the cornerstone of this? Well, there's two cornerstones, really. One, of course, I'll talk about. But the cornerstone are the 12 steps. Are you her replacement? Lose some, gain some. That's the way it works out. Now, enough of the movement. Just sit down. Take your punishment like a man. But in 1939, this man wrote a book. Late 1938, 39, wrote a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, which most of us are familiar with. And in that book, in the call to action, chapter 5, they have these 12 steps, which are roughly based on, you came back, darling. We've gained one net, because she came back and she came in new, so Jesus. But in these 12 steps, which were based pretty much on what he had learned in the Oxford movement, where he and his doctor had gotten together, in the Oxford movement. In fact, the Oxford movement had 5 or 6 tenets, and these are 12, because he put in some things about being ready to do things instead of before you do them, and became willing to take action and making a decision and so on. And as a rule, it is generally thought that these 12 steps are what make Alcoholics Anonymous go. because the people of our type who do not practice them get drunk. And it's ridiculous because there's nothing in them to the newcomer's eye that says, why would I do that? That's just some more goodness. I tried being good. That doesn't work. And so we are going to, this weekend, talk a little bit about the steps and their, I suppose, their dynamics. And you will hear a lot of fine talks, as I will tomorrow and Sunday morning. But my job is to introduce you to the first three steps of these. And to me, they're, in many ways, the most important part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in not doing the first three steps kept me slipping for 10 years. It took me from a high-bottom drunk to being thrown out of a mission on Skid Row, my teeth kicked out, and I would have bet my life there was no answer to my problem. Because I knew all about AA. But I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. And that's the great premise in this, that first step. It's like saying, we have to admit you're an alcoholic. Okay. That's like restaurants saying, well, we're going to have an elephant sandwich. Great. I'd like to, we're not going to kill our elephant for one sandwich, you know. It goes a little more smoothly than it does in real life. And I, the last time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came out of a Skid Row mission. As I said, my teeth kicked out, covered with blood and vomit, no clothes that had been lost, my money, my ID, everything, my family, everything was gone. And I would have bet my life that morning, I am not an alcoholic, because I'd been going to AA off and on for 10 years. And I knew what an alcoholic was. Alcoholics are people whose problem is alcohol, and they come to AA and admit their problem is alcohol, and that makes them feel better. Then they return to God, and then they help others, and as their personalities change, they become more giving, and they help alcoholics. And I knew that very well, and I'd been a good AA, listening to a lot of guys try to help me. And I was dying on the street. I weighed 120-some pounds and had nothing going for me. I was in a city where I didn't know anybody. I knew one guy, and he'd give me some money. He wouldn't give me any more. He says, you're a bum. He said, you gave me my start once years ago, and I gave you a couple $100 for that the other day, but no more. You're a bum. And two guys threw me out of this mission and said, stay out of here, you mooch. I tried something. I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the LCD Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time, New Yorker, Sterling Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. You know. I started that dumb old mission. And I it was raining, and I knew I was going to die. I just felt I was going to die. But I'd learned one thing in those years. I had a lot of ups and downs in the years, as you can imagine. And that was this. If you really got to get out of the rain, if you're really sick, got to get some help right away. There's always one place you can go. When no one will take you, you can always go to an AA club. That's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. This one's mine, Jim. So I found out where the AA club was. He said someplace called Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that was. And I took off and walked there, and I counted later in my car, some years later, 7.5 miles up Wilshire Boulevard, sick and cold, my mouth dripping blood. And I got to this dumb old club, this same old crap. Admit you're an alcoholic, son. Turn over to God. Return to God. Hey. Maybe it'd be better if I just died in the rain. But I went in there and I lurked, and that night there was a meeting, and I went to the meeting because they served cake. I ate about 4 pounds of cake because I could chew that. Then everybody went home, and I sat there, and everybody's gone home except the manager, and he's trying to close up. It was raining outside, and I was sick. And I had one tool going for me. I thought I had developed a newcomer look that was just 100% if I could work on it. And I said to the manager, I said, pardon me, I'm a newcomer, and I have no place to sleep. Could you help me? He said, "You're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn from Laguna Beach left a 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. Doesn't run, but he can try. You can sleep in that." You mean to tell me Alcoholics Anonymous in California that you offer me a place in an abandoned car? Yeah, good deal, huh? Oh, that's a good deal. And I remember sleeping in that abandoned car that night, and my mouth was bleeding. I thought, how can this be happening to me? This can't be happening. I had burned off everybody. And the next day, it was Sunday, and I went to the club, and they had a morning meeting. And I ate a lot of cake, and they had a great talk. I mean, they had a meeting on spirituality, and I had to get up and leave that because I am not, I don't want to hear about God. Not for the obvious reason. You think, well, you don't believe in God. Oh, no. I don't want to hear about God because I do believe in God. And I know I'm going to hell. And I can't stand that. So I don't want to be around when they're talking about it. And that afternoon I lurked around that damn old club. And they had a TV in the back room. I watched a football game, which saved my bacon. I thought, now there's another meeting. Then the manager of the club said, "You know, kid, on the weekends you can come in here. But during the weekdays you're supposed to be a member of the club. Otherwise you can't come in." But he said, "You're such a mess, you'll die in our parking lot. So you can come in, but you can't ask anybody for money. And don't none of your smart remarks," because I'd already made some smart remarks. And he said, "And you have to go to our meeting every night." I thought, oh, Jesus. If I had a coin, I'd have flipped it, I'll tell you. I thought, all right. And I sat in those damn meetings, and I slept in that damn abandoned car. And I went and listened to these pukes talk about how wonderful it was to stop drinking. And had no idea that'd be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. Tonight, when Jim so well read the 12 traditions. Am I getting gracious in my old age or what? They were terrible, Jim, for quite a... No. The third tradition read, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I had no desire to stop drinking. Not at all. Not at all. I had a desire to stop drinking once in my life. Really a strong desire. I'd been in and out of AA for a number of years by this time. But I had a little problem. When I drink too much, sometimes I have a need to counsel police officers. Bad boy. And I used to, from time to time, go to jail overnight. Just overnight. I'm no big felon, but... And after a while, I could go out in the morning and go home, take a shower, and go to work. You know, nobody ever knew it. But this one time, I came out of the jail in the morning, and there was a guy there to meet me, neighbor. And I how the hell would he do that for? I said, what are you doing here, Bill? He said, "Just came down to tell you, I'm so sorry. Well, you were out drunk last night, your little son died, and we couldn't find you. And it just about killed me, because I had a bunch of little daughters and one little boy. And that I just almost went crazy over that, because he's going to be my salvation," I thought. Anyway, we finally went up to Wisconsin and buried him in his grandmother's grave, a little country churchyard outside of a town called Black River Falls. And before we buried him, I put my hand in his little casket. I said, "John Immisland, this will never happen again. I promise you, it will never happen again." And I went back to El Paso, where I was working at that time, and I drank a little bit. I started to see it going to start to lose control again, so I stopped for Baby John. And I'll tell you, I went to work in the morning, came home at night. My kids and I started eating dinner together for the first time in a long time. We'd always say a little prayer at every meal for Baby John, just like somebody, like Easter. Somebody had died, but he died for our sins. And we'd go for rides, and once in a while we'd go to the show on Friday night. It probably was the best 3 or 4 weeks of my life. But then something happened to me intermittently my whole adult life. That is, whenever I quit drinking, it goes very well. But sooner or later, somebody seems to put an invisible spring in my gut, and the next day they start to tighten it. And it doesn't come out as, "I need a drink." It just comes out as a little growing restlessness, a little irritability, little tired of the sermons. Get off the sermon. You told me what I did. Leave me alone. And eventually at the job, they start to be look like dummies they are. And whatever technicolor there is in the world gradually grays out. And it gets bad. And I've spent thousands of dollars to beat that emotion. I've gone into psychoanalysis for thousands of dollars. I've joined cults. I've read books. I did everything to try to do something. But I'll tell you something. The only sure answer to that is a couple drinks. And then sometimes I drink too much. I say, see, your problem was alcohol, wasn't it? You have to say, yeah, I guess it was. But I don't, inside I want to say, no, it wasn't. But alcohol was the only thing that saved me. In fact, I remember thinking, alcohol is the best friend I ever had. And tonight I'll tell you that too. Alcohol is the best friend I ever had. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. Cities come and go. But when a few drinks is just making, releasing you, God, that's great for you. You know, I don't know what made me think about this, but they have all these tests for alcoholism, 20 questions and 40 questions and 60 questions someplace. I got a better one than that. Just take a guy who is, you might suspect, or a girl, and put them somewhere where they can't get a drink for a week. Feed them, let them get rested up. And after a week, give them a big drink. And if they go, it's hard for us to realize, but most people go, they'll never know what it's like. Can you imagine saying to your glass, was it good for you? But I stopped drinking, and it got bad, and it got so bad I couldn't stand it. My wife took the children to church one Sunday morning, and I parked the car in the garage and hooked up a hose and exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I was just crazed. And a guy next door happened to be sitting in his breakfast nook, and he saw me go in there and heard the motor running, and I didn't come out, and he walked over and found me dead in the car and pulled me out and breathed and beat my chest and rushed me to the hospital, and they oxygenated me and examined me for several days and committed me to the state insane asylum as being severely emotionally impaired. Now that's how it gets when I stop drinking. That is not an alcohol problem. That's something terribly wrong inside of me that I've always suspected was there all along anyway. So why would I stop drinking this time? I was in that nut house for a long time, until the next year, before I found a way out. I had to pretend to be an alcoholic to get out. A sad story. After 2 months of shock treatments, I'd pretend to be anything. I said, you want me to test your light bulb? Now, why would I stay sober this time? I had no desire to stay sober. It leads to madness. It leads to insanity. It's suicide, despair. And the best I can tell you is that I saw a guy in those forced meetings that week that I'd seen in the movies. He was a movie actor. A movie actor. That means he's rich. I'll bet he would like a new friend. So I moved in on him. He didn't want a new friend. But, you know, I thought something by Friday I had to answer. I said, Bob, I so admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? I said, sure, kid, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. One thing I knew about him, I heard him talk, he was dumb. He was dumb. I was much smarter than he was. I knew that I could play him like a tambourine if I wanted to. And I found out he wasn't a big movie star at all. He'd been in 3 movies, and I'd seen 2 of them. And so he was just a character actor. He was a radio actor, if anything. They said he was not a very good actor. He was a good actor, because he acted nice in the meetings. And I took a lot of acting for that guy, I'll tell you. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Just, do this. Now, then, why am I taking this crap? Because he was my only meal ticket out of there. But he's a good man. He tried to help me. I tried to be honest with him. I said, Bob, I want you to know going in, I'm not really an alcoholic. I sometimes drink like one, but I got something terribly wrong inside of me. I just want you to know that so you won't think I'm trying to scurry out or something. He said, I'm glad you told me that, kid. I'm glad to know that. But he would take me with him a couple times to hear him talk, or he would talk to me in the club sometimes. But he would sometimes say things that were so dumb, I was almost embarrassed to be with him, you know, just dumb. One night we were meeting somewhere, and he said to somebody, either maybe to me or somebody, he said, as long as you think your problem is alcohol, you're going to die drunk. On the way back, I said, Bob, why do you say that to people in Alcoholics Anonymous? These poor bastards, they have an alcohol problem. That's what they're there for. And you tell them they don't have an alcohol problem. He said, if they got an alcohol problem, they shouldn't be in AA. Take it up spice. Take it up time. I said, light's kind of hot on the set today, Bob. So I'll tell you something, kid. I'll tell you how you overcome an alcohol problem. You don't go to AA. What do you do, Bob? You quit drinking, you clean up your act, and you're stoic sober. I bet that doesn't work. I've tried that 200 times. That's right, kid. That's because your problem isn't alcohol. I know that, Bob. What do you think it is? He says, something that sounds like alcohol and fools a lot of people. There's something called alcoholism. I said, oh, Jesus, Bob. Don't play word games with me. I look terrible, but I'm smarter than hell. Alcoholism, hooray, I'm cured. Shut up, he explained. And he gave me a long harangue thereafter, most of which I was able to blot out, thank God, but some of it crept in. And much to my surprise, looking back later, was the foundation of my sobriety. I never guessed it at the time. I never had any big breakthrough. But he said, kid, here's the difference. An alcohol problem was overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for most of us looks exactly the same to the naked eye as an alcohol problem, this mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. I said, Jesus, Bob, I never heard anybody say that before. They always say, get sober and you'll be all right. He said, nah, getting sober makes it worse. That's the worst part of the disease. I go, God, Bob, then why do these people drink alcohol? My God, they know it's going to eat them up, to do some bad things to them. Why do they drink it? He said, that's not the reason they drink it, kid. You don't seem to know very much for being around A all the time. He said, you know what an alcoholic is? It's a person who gets an unnatural reaction to alcohol. Yes, I know that. It sets up the phenomenon of craving, and then you go wild and go mad and drink till you die or go insane. He said, that's podium talk. I'll tell you why people drink alcohol, kid. He had a Coke in his hand. He says, if this were Johnny Walker, I'll tell you. When I have a drink, it almost instantly alters my perception of reality. When I have a couple drinks, it almost instantly alters my relationship to the world around me. When I have a few drinks, almost instantly it makes me taller and more self-contained, and them less threatening and frightening to me. I said, Jesus, Bob, what's wrong with that? And he said, and I quote him, I hate to quote him, but I must. He said, because it is not really happening, you asshole. I was like, okay, Bob, I see that. I can see that now. I can understand that because it happens to me, too. I said, you mean it doesn't happen to all people who drink? He said, no. Most people drink. They never know. That's what makes us here. That puts us here. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for other people. Unless the alcohol is doing something special for you, you'll never have anything do it to you because you'll stop. But when it's doing it for you and changing your life, you've got to have it. And I thought about that later. All the therapy I've had, There's a man went out to get a cup of coffee. Did you bring one for the speaker? Yeah. Not easy keeping track of everybody. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I try to be nice. But can you know of any therapy, any psychotherapy, any medical therapy, any religious therapy that'll take a guy walking down the street just preparing to commit suicide, just can't stand another day of this? Maybe stop in and have one going away drink. Goodbye. And in 5 minutes you're down the bar saying things like, "You with anyone, Granny?" Now that's something special. Jesus, Bob. Okay, I understand that, but the meaning right there, a guy got up and talked, said he'd been sober 2 years and got drunk again. And he said he wasn't comfortable the whole 2 years and he got finally got drunk again. Why would he do that, Bob? He said, "That's just the end of the disease, kid. You don't seem to know very much." And he had a theory that I didn't pay much attention to, but I heard a tape of it three or four years ago, and I thought, God, that's right on. When people are born and they're raised, it's very hard being a kid growing up in the world. There's so much you have to learn. You have to learn how to get along with people. Sometimes you don't like them, but you get along with them. You have to learn, you have to give things to get what you want. Some days life is just crappy and people treat you badly. Some days life is just grand and things are wonderful. He said the whole process is called maturing. And if you become a mature individual, you can live a very comfortable life. Hold a job, get along with your co-employees, get along with your mate, know how to handle your kids, get along with the neighbors, go on square vacations, enjoy them. He said, but this almost never happens to alcoholics. Said, why not, Bob? Because these people have had to deal with problems and find solutions to their problems and how to overcome conflicts by acting differently. We have found along the way, each of us, that I don't have to deal and find answers. I can drink them away. Here's to you, household finance. Here's to you, bitch. I never liked you anyway. Hey, Mr. Carlson, take your job and shove it up your nose, will you? Jesus, Bob, that works for me. He said, but what you don't know, kid, you're building a little container of unsolved childish emotions in your gut. We call them alcoholic emotions because it makes it sound better to people. But they're childish emotions. And he says, sooner, people like us, soon, sometimes, we always get to a point somewhere along the line, we're going to quit, going to go to work, come home, not be a drunk, get along, get sick of all this crap we're taking, it's going to be fine, we're going to do a good job, and never once realize it is impossible for me to do that on a continuing basis. Why? Because sooner or later, someone will trigger those emotions. Someone will hurt my feelings. Someone will say something bad about me, and I'll hear about it. Somebody will threaten me, and it starts... It starts to get stronger. When I was young and fancy free, I'd get those feelings. I'd go to the guy that's doing it to me and I'd punch him in the face and quit my job. But when you got kids and house payments, you can't do that. So you got to take it. And you have to decide, how can I get back at that guy or that woman, whoever she is, doing this to me? And little by little, the days go by, you can see that he's got some friends that are probably doing it to me too. And they're trying to screw me around. And eventually you can lie awake at night and think about it. God, those bastards, why are they doing this to me? And it gets awfully bad. Scientists who study it, people like us, say we can get to a point where we literally must drink to preserve our sanity. And so I drink. And then I drink too much. And the The pilot light goes off. Away we go. I lose the job finally, or I leave the job, and somebody says, Clancy, why did you leave that job? What a great job you had. Oh, they're a bunch of phonies. I didn't like that job anyway. I didn't like it. Again and again and again. I said, Jesus, Bob, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. I've had some big jobs. I made some money. I was somebody. But sooner or later, I'd always have to quit or get in a fight with somebody, or somebody make me feel bad and I'd withdraw. Just again, just one thing after another. Seemed to be a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, but it's killing me. Now here I am sleeping in an abandoned car, Bob, and I'm smarter than all those people that fired me. He said, there's a name for people like you. I thought, uh-oh. I hope he doesn't use that profane word again. He said, you're an alcoholic. I said, my God, if that's what an alcoholic is, that's what I am. I can't believe it. But that day was in mid-December of 1958, a long time ago. And that I began to believe. I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic, but it made me listen differently when people talked about alcoholism. See, is it the way I thought or the way he described it? And little by little, it became quite clear to me. And I've talked many times, worked with people, and they say to me, but, yeah, but you were thrown out of a mission with your teeth kicked out. I mean, I'm still working at a think tank, you know. It turns out the whole concept of the first step is this. It isn't that you were thrown out of a mission. Over the years, I've sponsored a lot of divergent people. Man that put the flag on the moon, movie stars, Academy Award winning director, clergyman, psychiatrist, losers. I like to give Mad a little juice, if you don't mind. What do we all have in common? We weren't all thrown out of the midnight mission with our teeth kicked out. We all were in a situation where sobriety was painful, and the answer was drinking, and now drinking became intolerable. And sobriety is intolerable. And there you are. And you just limp back and forth. Next time it'll be different. I said, my God. And I, since that day, I said, at one level or another, I've always believed I was an alcoholic. And things didn't get a lot better at all. I didn't get any better. But at least I got over my fear that I was secretly insane. There was a reason for it. And I listened to people talk with a different ear. Oh, yeah, that's what they mean. Oh, yeah, yeah. So to me, the first step is so hard for many people to get because they think it has something to do with having an alcohol problem. And it isn't. It's partially an alcohol problem. But unless you have a sobriety problem, you won't have an alcohol problem. Alcohol has to do something special for you, whether it's going to work in the United States Senate or working and shoveling dirt on the street. And, you know, you go to the Capitol of Washington, D.C., Sandy knows very well. Go, have to think about that tonight. In the meeting, there's a meeting in the Capitol Tuesday morning, 7:30, secret meeting where our government meets to discuss their alcoholism. As, I've been sober a long time, so I've had opportunities to do a lot of things. The last few years, I've had the chance to go to some odd places, you know, Cape Town, South Africa, talk, and Johannesburg, and Berlin and Paris and London and Dublin and Belfast and Oslo and Sweden. Last year I was in Bali in Indonesia and Australia and New Zealand. You think you'd really find exotic AA in these places. But except for the accents, you hear the same emotions you hear in your home group. It's just miraculous how at that level we're all so similar. Because you can sit here and think, I'm totally different because look around. But you stay here a while till you get down to that level and think, my God, they're just like me. What a remarkable thing that is. So the most important thing I've ever learned in my life was that I was an alcoholic. Because if I didn't believe I was an alcoholic, I could not do the things I had to do later. The second step, I'll go through this kind of quick. But, you know, if you go to say you're an alcoholic, pretty soon the sponsors are all the same. Well, time to work the steps. Jesus, Bob. I can't return to God. I know you mean well, but I have reasons of my own. I didn't want to go through the whole thing. I'm a Norwegian Lutheran, and I've believed in God since I was a little boy. And by the time I'd broken all 10 commandments, I realized there's no hope for me. So I don't want to go to hear about God. I said, I can't return to God, Bob. He says, nothing in AA says you got to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself, Bob? Does that fool the other boys and girls? Doesn't fool me, baby. It doesn't say that either. Why don't you read the damn thing on the wall? It asks you to come to believe in something. Can't you come to believe in God? I said, no, not in the way they want me to. He said, can't you come to believe in AA? Don't you like AA? Well, I like it a little better than I used to, but not much. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? I said, of course you are, Bob. He said, congratulations, I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. He tried, but he couldn't. But that's the thing in that step. I got to now, not everybody might be starting at the place I did. But I started about as far back from the beginning as you can start. But if you're having difficulty, you got to remember this. You have to come to believe there's a power here. You don't have to know what that power is. No, you don't have to find out. You just have to believe there's a power here because this room is full of people who have felt as goofy as you have, and they're staying sober. So there must be some power here. Sometime later, maybe you'll identify that power and you live with it comfortably. But at the moment, don't worry about it. But the kicker is on the end of that step. Well, restore me to sanity. What the hell is sanity? You can read 10 textbooks on mental health and get 10 different definitions of sanity. But oddly enough, insanity is easy to define. When the brain, human brain, is under sufficient duress and conflict, that in desperation it cries out to maintain its neural integrity, its final desperation gasp is making portions of reality look different than they are. That is called psychosis. When your brain can't take anymore, and if the whole bit, it's easy to spot, they put you away. But usually it's just small amounts, and you can't tell when they're going to be triggered. You're reading the paper about a guy who lived next door to this guy for 10 years. Nice guy, came home one night, took a rifle, killed his 4 kids, killed his wife, killed himself. What the hell would make him do that? Something triggered that psychosis in him. Psychosis is a dreadful thing. And we talk in AA about, I was psychotic, then I wasn't, then I wasn't. Once you are psychotic, you just about always stay that way, I'll guarantee you. But here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. Isn't that odd? You'd think we'd be right up there in the front lines. Another failure on your part. Why don't alcoholics become psychotic? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, I drink alcohol. And it alters my perception of reality. Without even being aware of it, I have the power to induce temporary psychosis. And tomorrow I'll be sorry. You ask me, why did you do that? I don't know why I did, but I know the first drink changed my relationship to the world around me. We talk about psychosis, illness, alcoholism. The disease of psychosis is not what we're here for. You say, if you're new, you may read, well, it says alcoholism is the second greatest cause of insanity. That's right. But not from psychosis. It's an entirely different version. Everybody in this room that's ever got drunk very often knows what it feels like to wake up in the morning and need to put the fire out. Jesus. Why would a fluid do that to you? Because alcohol is the only fluid I ever heard of that dries out your body as it dries, goes through. It kills the cells in your body as it passes through. And every time you drink a great deal, thousands and thousands and thousands of your bodily cells dry out. Desiccate, I think the word is called. Then if the next day or some other time you induce fluids, they come alive again. Then you drink again and they die again. And thousands of times this happens. They just keep doing it. There's only two organs in the body that when the cells die, they do not revive. One is your liver, one is your brain. And that's what happens to people with us. Well, the livers go bad and the brain, eventually you drink enough. It takes a long time. You got millions of cells to kill, but you can kill enough of them till your brain dries out. You can't function. And one of the great ironies of life, we call that a wet brain. Not funny at all. Not funny at all. Most of you will never see a case of it. I see them all the time. I wish to hell I didn't. But you'll never see them, I don't think, ever. I'll tell you what happens to people with wet brain. They're not wandering around meetings saying, I think I'm crazy. They're sitting down a ward somewhere, and people come and change their diapers and feed them and put them to bed and get them up and change their diapers and feed them and put them to bed and get them up. Just like last stages of Alzheimer's, except Alzheimer's has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholic insanity, you can sit like that for 50 years if your body's strong enough. The family comes down to see if Mom knows him. Hi, Mom, we couldn't see you. I don't know you. Get out of here. I hate you. Leave me alone. They cry and go home. Dreadful, dreadful thing. But alcoholics, that's what happens to them. They sit in that ward. And I hope you never see a case of alcoholic insanity, because it's bad news. But what I have to believe in the second step is this. I guess what it means, I have a tendency to believe that the steps mean what they say. They don't really need a lot of interpretation. I have to come to believe there's in my desperation, there's a power here that I can try to believe in, if I can't hardly very do it very well, that will make it unnecessary for me to induce temporary psychosis. To stay sober. To not drink. And then the third step, which is the last one, that was always scared me, because that was out and out religion. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. What the hell does that mean? I could not take that step. So I rewrote it in my mind. Sounds funny, but it saved my life. I said, I will try to do what Bob says. And it saved my life. Because as he had me take actions little by little, my perceptions began to change. I find at the end of my first year, I was held a job for 4 months before I got fired. My second year, I held a line 5 or 6 months before I got fired. After my second birthday, I had a little room in Hollywood with a little hot plate and a little bathroom of my own. And God, I felt good. I liked that better than any big house I ever had. Come home and go to the library and get some books, come home and read, and just read all day Sunday and have fun. But now I've got a big house that's full of people and making me crazy. But I got a job after my second birthday as beginning writer in a medical corporation. And I'd been quite a well-known writer, but now as a beginning writer. And I said, this is where I'm going to make my move. I'm going to make my move now. I'm going to make my life together. And I went to work there determined. I'm going to do the best I can, give it all I got. And I was there about 4 or 5 days, and somebody hurt my feelings. Somebody said, that guy doesn't have any front teeth. And I didn't, but I learned to carry my lip like this. But I guess they spotted me. And I thought, how do you like that? Doing all I can, and that rotten fink is ridiculing me. What's the even sense of trying? I might as well just punch him and get another job. But I knew if I did that, I'd have to explain it to that damn Bob. So I called him, Bob, you did it. Here's what you do. That won't work, Bob. This guy's a no good. He said, try it. So I went to the guy and said, just a question, Jim. Why do you, why do you ridicule me because I have no front teeth? Why do you ridicule me for doing this? He said, oh. Not at all. You misunderstand. I was telling somebody that you must have had a very tough life somewhere along the line because you've got so much ability, and here you are starting out, and you got no front teeth, and you're wearing old clothes. And I'll tell you, I can't tell you how much I respect you. And I said, oh. There must have been 20 times in that first year on that job that I had to call Bob. And the time I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising in that big corporation. Had front teeth, smiled a lot. Many of you new people back there have lost teeth. Let me give you hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio, became the number one hard rock station in the world. And I was down 10 years sober, downtown doing public relations oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. Boom. Because actions I took based on those steps. In my early on sobriety, I almost went and my sponsor took my extreme pain and had me write an inventory that I swore I'd never write. And he had me make amends. You will hear about it from excellent speakers the next 2 days. The steps of AA. Because it turns out the purpose of AA, much to my surprise, if you're kind of new, you may look at me, now later this year, if I survive, I'll turn 50. Give you something to shoot at, John. Never let them up when they're down, I always say. But, you know, you might think, Jesus, this old fool is getting drier and drier and drier. I'm going to burst into flame up there any minute. The purpose of A is not to stay drier and drier and drier. It turns out it took me a long time to understand this. But I believe in everything I believe that the purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my perception of reality, to make it a friendly place. To change my relationship to the world around me, so I'm getting along. To little by little make me taller and more self-contained inside of me and less threatened by their likes or dislikes. And that can happen when you're a month sober. It happened to me when after I discovered I was an alcoholic. Didn't last long, maybe an hour, but I had a good feeling. And the purpose of staying sober longer is to have it happen more often and longer. That's all. Just that thing. And the only problem with it is, as most of you know from my story, that sometimes it catches you unawares and you find yourself acting badly. When I was 15 years sober, I was on top of the world, baby. And I had one of those terrible feelings of doing better, feeling better. And one day I found myself leaving my job in Beverly Hills. And for the last 34 years, I've run this Skid Row mission that threw me out in 1958. And people say, why would you go back and give up your great career to do that damn mission? And there's no good answer to that question. Well, for such a significant decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. I'm still looking for those two bastards who did it to me. Once I get them. But Monday morning, I'll do something none of you will do, I don't suppose. I'll get up. I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles. My backyard, big backyard. Tomorrow, 150 AAs will be there playing ball and having fun, and I'll be in Cocoa Beach. Happy to be here. But I'll get up where I live, and I'll get in my car and drive down the Santa Monica Freeway through Beverly Hills, where my car still wants to get off, and go down to this ravaged, dreadful area of Los Angeles called Skid Row and park my car underneath the building and walk around the building and step over the bodies of men dying, men and women and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and abandonment and insanity. I'll spend the day with my staff trying to find ways how we can get to some of these people before they die and get them to acknowledge the fact they need help. That they're gonna. And eventually tonight I'll go home and have dinner and go to a meeting, feel good. Now, why would that be possible? Because that is not my MO at all. But that is the importance, I think, of the first three steps. Acknowledging that problem. Come to believe there's an answer here, even though you don't understand it. And then do what they tell you. Hard things, because my mind says, you can't, I know you mean well, but you can't know my needs as badly as I do. But they do. Because they're dealing with recovery and I'm dealing with sickness. So I trust that you will listen carefully for the next day and a half to a group of well-versed and intelligent experts in alcoholism talk about how you get better. Thank you.